For more than 50 years, Glyn Johns has been revered as one of rock and roll's greatest sound engineers and record producers. He was the man in the control booth driving the amazing sound of hundreds of albums, from the greatest Rolling Stones records to the Beatles' Abbey Road and Let It Be, to the first albums from Led Zeppelin and the Eagles. In his new book, Sound Man, he describes what it was like to be present when the iconic music of a generation was being made and the quirky people behind the sound. His account is really valuable because Glyn Johns never touched a drug in his life, so his memories are funny and clear. Our executive producer, Derek Hewitt, is a big fan, so let's listen as he chats to Glyn Johns.
Hello, Glyn, and thanks for joining us on The Book Report.
My pleasure.
The title of your book, Sound Man, is especially apt and amusing because not only were you the man managing the sound for the great groups of the last 50 years, you were often the only sober one in the studio because you never took drugs of any kind. You must have come under pressure to do so. So how did you resist?
It was very simple. I had absolutely no desire whatsoever. You can't do what I do if you're me, and if you're under the influence of anything, coffee would be about it. One, two, I objected to the principle at the beginning. In order to be accepted by somebody, you had to do whatever they were doing. That principle offended me enormously. So on two counts, it was very simple to do.
Well, good. You describe the job of producers to have an opinion and the ego to express it more convincingly than anyone else. Did the fact that you were sober make it easier to get your point across?
Well, it depends on how stoned the people I was talking to were. I could certainly string a sentence together, but,
right.
But I don't know how easy it was for them to understand.
Right. It's well known that you ran a very tight ship in the recording studio, and thank goodness you did. We probably wouldn't have a lot of the great music if you hadn't. But in the book, you mention several times how you may have been blinkered and hard-headed at times and had to be pushed by people like David Geffen to pay attention to various artists. But the book is really filled with generous acknowledgement of the contributions of others and the admission that you came around to recognize the greatness of people. And you generously acknowledge that you were wrong about, for example, Eric Clapton. What made you mellow out and become such a generous and giving guy?
Maybe I started taking drugs. No, that actually is not true. No, I have no idea. You know what? Yeah, I suppose you, as you get older, you mellow, don't you? Hopefully. And equally, I don't work anything like the same extent that I used to. So I have a little more free time, and therefore I'm not as quite stressed out as I used to be, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you mentioned working with your son is such a great blessing, and maybe that's one of the things that gets you calmer. Anyway. You also mentioned that you started working with the Stones again after engineering and producing some of the earlier albums, just as Mick Taylor was leaving, and you did a lot of sessions in Munich. So this was really fascinating, because you talk about a version of Fool to Cry that, as you say, eats the later version that they actually released. There are other places in the book where you mention, you know, better versions of songs than the ones that actually made it onto the air, and you hint that you may have tapes. This raises a really tantalizing prospect of hearing familiar music afresh. Do you think there's a chance that the groups or labels involved will ever allow you to release the Glyn Johns Mixes of the Masters album?
No, I don't think that for a second. And in fact, I'm biased in my opinion that they might be better than what was eventually released. I'm sure others wouldn't necessarily agree. And certainly in the case of the artist, and it's the artist's performance and life and career that these recordings supposedly represent. So I would honour their wishes above anybody else's anyway. But it's also something I would never seek to do. It's just, it's not important. Nothing's that important. The fact of the matter is that all that material's been released in perhaps a later mix or a different format, and people have learned to enjoy it that way, and that's fine. I don't think it's that important, to be honest.
Well, as a Stones fan, I'd love to hear that mix, but
well, I'm sure show you with. I'll tell you what, I'll send you a CD.
We're speaking with Glyn Johns on The Book Report.
You really seem to enjoy bringing together British and American musicians, and you paint wonderful and very kind pictures of the incredible talents you worked with. After reading the book, you know, I can't wait to listen again to, for example, Emmylou Harris or Georgie Fame or the White Mansions and Legend of Jesse James albums, which are sort of lesser-known folks, at least in the U.S., but who are sound incredibly worth re-listening to. So what do you think makes some great music just not get recognized at the time that it's released?
Well, there are very often commercial reasons for it. And you mentioned White Mansions and Jesse James. Both of those records had a collaboration of several artists. They weren't all on the label that eventually released the record, A&M. And so there are contractual reasons why you can't have a single release or whatever, because the other label won't let you do it. But equally, as a result of that, as we all know, the way of promoting any album is by releasing singles, and they get airplay, and that gets everyone to hear the record. So with both of those albums in particular, there wasn't really what would be termed as a commercially successful single on either of them, which actually doesn't mean anything as far as the quality of the music is concerned. We all know that there's some great music that would never see the light of day on a single. But they're perfect examples of why those records didn't get the attention that they deserve.
Right.
Today. And there's another record I made many years ago with Pete Townsend and Ronnie Lane called Rough Mix, which I talk about in the book also. And I think it's one of the best records I ever made. And it got sat on, I think, by MCA, who had their own reasons for it, because I think The Who were about to release an album shortly thereafter, and they didn't want it to conflict.
You've worked with all of the very best. If you had to put together a fantasy supergroup of people who've never played together, who would be in your lineup, do you think?
I do love mixing musicians together who, particularly, as you just mentioned, from the United States and England or United Kingdom, that there's a difference in the way Americans feel in a rhythm section, feel the groove of the song to Americans. And very often the combination of the two can be very interesting. But the most important thing is to put people in a room with each other who would get a buzz off playing with them. And I've managed to do that. Like, for example, the Ryan Adams record, Norah Jones and Ben Montench, both extraordinary keyboard players, quite different from each other, but we used them on the record, and the end result is quite remarkable, actually. More in what they didn't play than what they did. They left so much space for each other out of respect. But that record is a great example of, they're all astonishing musicians, as is Ryan, and it's a great example of what we're just talking about. Everyone in that room had a massive respect for each other, and everybody in particular wanted to work with Ryan and experience what it would be like to work with them, and it really paid off.
Wow, what a great experience to be there. Readers, Glyn Johns' book, Sound Man, is a must-read for anyone trying to understand the last 50 years of amazing music. Thanks for joining us today, Glyn.
Well, thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.